The Raven inspected the hallway clock with the practiced eye of one who knows the value of good props. As Susan had noted, it was not so much small as dimensionally displaced. It looked small, but in the same way that something very big a long way away looks small, that is to say, the mind keeps reminding the eyes that they're wrong. But this was up close as well. It was made of some dark, age-blackened wood. There was a pendulum which oscillated slowly. The clock had no hands.
"Impressive," said the Raven. "That scythe blade on the pendulum, nice touch, very gothic. No one could look at that clock and not think, 'Squeak!' All right, I'm coming."
The Raven fluttered across to an ornamental doorframe. There was a skull and bones motif on it.
"Excellent taste," it said. "Squeak, squeak."
"Well, anyone can do plumbing, I expect," said the Raven. "Interesting fact. Did you know the lavatory was actually named after Sir Charles Lavatory? Not many people know. Squeak!"
The Death of Rats pushed at the big door leading to the kitchen. It swung open with a creak, but here again there was something not quite right. A listener had the sense that the creak had been added by someone who, feeling that a door like that with a door surround like that ought to creak, had inserted one. Albert was washing up at the stone sink and staring at nothing.
"How?"
he said, turning.
"It's you. What's this thing?"
"I'm a raven," said the Raven nervously. "Incidentally, one of the most intelligent birds. Most people would say it's the minor bird, but..."
"Squeak!"
The Raven ruffled its feathers.
"I'm here as an interpreter," it said.
"Has he found him?"
said Albert. The Death of Rats squeaked at length.
"Looked everywhere, no sign," said the Raven.
"Then he don't want to be found,"
said Albert. He smeared the grease off a plate with a skull pattern on it.
"I don't like that."
"Squeak!" "The Rat says that's not the worst thing," said the Raven. "The Rat says you ought to know what the granddaughter has been doing."
The Rat squeaked, the Raven talked. The plate shattered on the sink.
"I knew it,"
Albert shouted.
"Saving him? She hasn't got the faintest idea. Right, I'm going to sort this out. The master thinks he can slope off, eh? Not from old Albert. You two, wait here."
There were already posters up in Pseudopolis. News travels fast, especially when CMOT Dibbler is paying for the horses.
"Hello, Pseudopolis!"
They had to call out the city watch. They had to organise a bucket chain from the river. Ashfelt had to stay outside Buddy's dressing room with a club, with a nail in it. Albert, in front of a scrap of mirror in his bedroom, brushed his hair furiously. It was white. At least, long ago it was white. Now it was the colour of a tobacco addict's index finger.
"It's my duty, that's what it is,"
he muttered.
"Don't know where he'd be without me. Maybe he does remember the future, but he always gets it wrong. Oh, he can go on worrying about the eternal verities. But who has to sort it out when all's said and done? Muggins, that's who."
He glared at himself in the mirror.
"Right,"
he said. There was a battered shoebox under the bed. Albert pulled it out very, very carefully and took the top off. It was half full of cotton wool. Nestling in the wool, like a rare egg, was a lifetimer. Engraved on it was the name Alberto Malich. The sand inside was frozen, immobile, in mid-paw. There wasn't much left in the top bulb. No time passed here. It was part of the arrangement. He worked for death and time didn't pass, except when he went into the world. There was a scrap of paper by the glass. The figures 91 had been written at the top, but lower numbers trailed down the page after it. 73, 68, 37, 19.
19.
He must have been daft. He'd let his life leak away by hours and minutes. And there had been a lot more of them lately. There'd been all that business with the plumber, of course, and shopping. The master didn't like to go shopping. It was hard to get served. And Albert had taken a few holidays because it was nice to see the sun, any sun, and feel wind and rain. The master did his best, but he could never get them right. And decent vegetables, he couldn't do them properly either. They never tasted grown. 19 days left in the world. But more than enough. Albert slipped the lifetimer into his pocket, put on an overcoat, and stamped back down the stairs.
"You," he said, pointing to the Death of Rats, "you can't sense a trace of him. It must be something. concentrate. Squeak. What did he say?
He said all he can remember is something about sand.
Sand, said Albert. All right. Good start. We search all the sand.
Squeak?
Wherever the master is, he'll make an impression.
Cliff awoke to a swish-swish sound. The shape of Glod was outlined in the light of dawn, wielding a brush.
What are you doing, dwarf?
I got asphalt to get some paint, said Glod. These rooms are a disgrace.
Cliff raised himself on his elbows and looked around.
What do you call the colour on the door?
O'Donnell. Nice.
Thank you, said Glod.
The curtains are good too.
The door creaked open. Asphalt came in with a tray and kicked the door shut behind him.
Oh, sorry, he said.
I'll paint over the mark, said Glod.
Asphalt put the tray down, trembling with excitement.
Everyone's talking about you guys, he said, and they're saying it was about time they built a new theatre anyway. I've got you eggs and bacon, eggs and rat, eggs and coke, and what was it? Oh, yes, the captain of the watch says if you're still in the city at sunrise, he will personally have you buried alive. I've got the cart all ready by the back door. Young women have been writing things on it in lipstick. Nice curtains, by the way.
All three of them looked at Buddy.
He hasn't moved, said Glod. Flopped down right after the show and out like a light.
He was certainly leaping around last night, said Cliff.
Buddy continued to snore, gently.
When we get back, said Glod, we ought to have a nice holiday somewhere.
That's right, said Cliff, if we get out of this alive. I'm going to put my rock kit on my back and take a long walk. And the first time someone says to me, what are them things on your back? That's when I'm going to settle down.
Asphalt peered down into the street.
Can you all eat fast, he said. Only there's some men in uniform out there, with shovels.
Back in Ankh-Morpork, Mr. Cleet was astonished.
But we hired you, he said.
The term is retained, not hired, said Lord Downey, head of the Assassin's Guild. He looked at Cleet with an expression of unconcealed distaste.
Unfortunately, however, we can no longer entertain your contract.
They're musicians, said Mr. Cleet. How hard can they be to kill?
My associates are somewhat reluctant to talk about it, said Lord Downey. They seem to feel that the clients are protected in some way. Obviously, we will return the balance of your fee.
Protected,
muttered Cleet, as they stepped thankfully through the archway of the Assassin's Guild.
Well, I told you what it was like in the drum when Satchel Mouth began.
That's just superstition, snapped Cleet.
He glanced up at a wall where three festival posters flaunted their primary colours.
It was stupid of you to think assassins would be any good outside the city, muttered Cleet.
Me? I never...
Get them more than 5 miles from a decent tailor and a mirror, and they all go to pieces,
Cleet added. He stared at the poster.
Free, he muttered. Did you put it about that anyone who plays at this festival is right out of the guild?
Yes, sir. I don't think they're worrying, sir. I mean, some of them have been getting together, sir. See, they say since there's a lot more people want to be musicians than we'll allow in the guild, then we should...
It's mob rule, said Cleet. Banding together to force unacceptable rules on a defenceless city...
Trouble is, sir, said Satchel Mouth, if there's a lot of them, if they think of talking to the palace, well, you know the patrician, sir.
Cleet nodded glumly. Any guild was powerful just so long as it self-evidently spoke for its constituency. He thought of hundreds of musicians flocking to the palace, hundreds of non-guild musicians. The patrician was a pragmatist. He never tried to fix things that worked. Things that didn't work, however, got broken. The only glimmer of hope was that they'd all be too busy messing around with music to think about the bigger picture. It had certainly worked for Cleet. Then he remembered that the blasted Dibbler man was involved. Expecting Dibbler not to think about anything concerning money was like expecting rocks not to think about gravity.
Hello? Albert?
Susan pushed open the kitchen door. The huge room was empty.
Albert!
She tried upstairs. There was her own room, and there was a corridor of doors that didn't open and possibly never could. The doors and frames had an all-in-one moulded-together look. Presumably Death had a bedroom, although proverbially Death never slept. Perhaps he just lay in bed reading. She tried the handles until she found one that turned. Death did have a bedroom. He'd got many of the details right, of course. After all, he saw quite a lot of bedrooms. In the middle of the acres of floor was a large four-poster bed, although when Susan gave it an experimental prod, it turned out that the sheets were as solid as rock. There was a full-length mirror and a wardrobe. She had a look inside just in case there was a selection of robes, but there was nothing in there except a few old shoes in the bottom. Old shoes always turn up in the bottom of every wardrobe. If a mermaid had a wardrobe, old shoes would turn up in the bottom of it. A dressing table held a jug and basin set with a motif of skulls and omegas and a variety of bottles and other items. She picked them up one by one. Aftershave lotion, pomade, breath freshener, a pair of silver-backed hairbrushes. It was all rather sad. Death clearly had picked up an idea of what a gentleman should have on his dressing room table without confronting one or two fundamental questions. Eventually, she found a smaller, narrower staircase. Albert? There was a door at the top. Albert? Anyone? It's not actually barging in if I call out first, she told herself. She pushed open the door. It was a very small room, really small. It contained a few sticks of bedroom furniture and a small, narrow bed. A small bookcase contained a handful of small, uninteresting-looking books. There was a piece of ancient paper on the floor, which when Susan picked it up turned out to be covered with numbers, all crossed out except the last one, which was 19. One of the books was Gardening in Difficult Conditions. She went back down to the study. She'd known that there was no one in the house. There was a dead feeling in the air. There was the same feeling in the gardens. Death could create most things, except for plumbing. But he couldn't create life itself. That had to be added like yeast in bread. Without it, everything was beautifully neat and tidy and boring, boring, boring. This is what it must have been like, she thought. And then one day, he adopted my mother. He was curious. She took the path through to the orchard again, and when I was born, Mum and Dad were so afraid that I felt at home here, they brought me up to be, well, a Susan. What kind of name is that for Death's granddaughter? A girl like that should have better cheekbones, straight hair, and a name with V's and X's in it. And there once again was the thing he'd made for her, all by himself, working it all out from first principles. A swing. A simple swing. It was already burning hot in the desert between Clatch and Hershibber. The air shimmied, and then there was a pop. Albert appeared on a sand dune. There was a clay brick fort on the horizon. The Clatchian Foreign Legion, he muttered, as sand began its inexorable progress into his boots. Albert trudged towards it, with the Death of Rats sitting on his shoulder. He knocked on the door, which had a number of arrows in it. After a while, a small hatch slid back.
What do you want, Effendi?
Said a voice from somewhere behind it. Albert held up a card.
Have you seen someone who didn't look like this?
He demanded. There was a silence.
Then, let's say, have you seen some mysterious stranger who didn't talk about his past?
Said Albert.
This is the Clatchian Foreign Legion, Effendi. People don't talk about their past. They join up
It dawned on Albert, as the pause lengthened, that it was up to him to get the conversation going again.
Forget?
Right. Forget, yes.
So, have you had any recent recruits who were a little, shall we say, odd?
Might have done, said the voice slowly. I can't remember.
The hatchway slammed shut. Albert hammered on it again. The hatchway opened.
Yes, what is it?
Are you sure you can't remember?
Remember what?
Albert took a deep breath.
I demand to see your commanding officer.
The hatch shut. The hatch opened.
Sorry. It appears that I am the commanding officer. You're not a Dreg or a Hershebian, are you?
Don't you know?
I'm pretty sure I must have done once.
You know how it is. Head like a
thing, with holes in. You drain lettuce in it.
There was the sound of bolts being pulled back, and a wicket door opened in the gateway. The possible officer was a sergeant, insofar as Albert was at all familiar with Clatchian ranks. He had the look about him of someone who, among the things he couldn't remember, would include a good night's sleep, if he could remember to. There were a few other Clatchian soldiers inside the fort, sitting or just barely standing. Many were bandaged, and there was a rather greater number of soldiers slumped or lying on the packed sand, who'd never need a night's sleep ever again.
"What's been happening here?"
said Albert. His tone was so authoritative that the sergeant found himself saluting.
"We were attacked by the dregs, sir," he said, swaying slightly. "Hundreds of them. They outnumbered us, what's the number after 9? Got a 1 in it. 10. 10-1, sir."
"I see you survived, though," said Albert.
"Ah," said the sergeant. "Yes, yes, that's where it all gets a bit complicated, in fact. Corporal, that's you. No, you just next to him. The one with the 2 stripes."
"Me?"
said a small fat soldier.
"Yes, yes. Tell him what happened."
"Oh, right. Well, the bastards had shot us full of arrows, right? And it looked like it was all up with us. Then someone suggested sticking bodies up on the battlements with their spears and crossbows and everything so the bastards would think we were still up to strength."
"It's not an original idea, mind you," said the sergeant. "It's been done thousands of times."
"Yeah,"
said the corporal awkwardly.
"That's what they must have thought. And then, when they was galloping down the sand dunes, when they was almost on us, laughing and everything, saying stuff like, 'Ha, ha, ha, that old trick again,' someone shouted, 'Fire!' And they did."
"The dead men?"
"I joined the Legion with your mind, with your mind,"
the corporal began.
"Forget?"
said Albert.
"That's right, forget. And I've been getting good at it. But I'm not going to forget my old mate Nadja Malik, stuck full of arrows and still giving the enemy what for,"
said the corporal.
"Not for a long time. I'm going to give it a try, mind you."
Albert looked up at the battlements. They were empty.
"Someone formed them up in formation and they all marched out afterwards," said the corporal. "And I went out to look just now, and there was just graves, and they must have dug them for one another."
"Tell me," said Albert, "who is this someone to whom you keep referring?"
The soldiers looked at one another.
We've just been talking about that," said the sergeant. "We've been trying to remember. He was in the pit when it started."
"Tall, was he?"
said Albert.
"Could have been tall, eh? Mm-hmm. Could have been tall,"
nodded the corporal.
He had a tall voice, certainly."
He looked puzzled at the words coming out of his own mouth.
"What did he look like?"
"Well, he had a, with a, he was a, well, more or less, he was..."
"Did he look loud and deep?"
said Albert. The corporal grinned with relief.
"That's him," he said. Private Beau,
can't quite remember his name. "I know that when he walked out of the the sergeant began, and began to snap his fingers irritably.
"The thing you open and shut. It's made of wood. Hinges and bolts on it.
Thank you.
Gate. That's right. Gate. When he went out of the gate, he said..."
"What was it he said, Corporal?"
"He said, 'Every last detail, sir.'"
Albert looked around the fort.
"So, he's gone."
"Who?"
"The man you were just telling me about."
"Oh. Oh, yes.
Have you any idea who he was, Effendi? I mean, it was amazing. Talk about morale."
"Esprit de corps,"
said Albert, who could be nasty at times.
"I suppose he didn't say where he was going next."
"Where who was going next?" said the sergeant, wrinkling his forehead in honest inquiry.
"Forget I asked,"
said Albert. He took a last look round the little fort. It probably didn't matter much in the history of the world whether it survived or not, whether the dotted line on the map went one way or the other. Just like the master, to tinker with things. "Sometimes he tries to be human too," he thought, "and he makes a pig's ear out of it."
"Carry on, sergeant,"
he said, and wandered back into the desert. The legionnaires watched him disappear over the dunes, and then got on with the job of tidying up the fort.
Who do you think he was?
Who?
The person you just mentioned.
Did I?
Did you what?
Albert crested a dune. From here, the dotted line was just visible, winding treacherously across the sand.
Squeak! You and me both, said Albert.
He removed an extremely grubby handkerchief from a pocket, knotted it in all four corners, and put it on his head.
Right,
he said. But there was a trace of uncertainty in his voice.
Seems to me we're not going to be logical about this.
Squeak?
I mean, we could be chasing him all over the place.
Squeak?
So maybe we ought to think about this.
Squeak?
Now, if you were on the disc, definitely feeling a bit strange, and could go absolutely anywhere, anywhere at all, where would you go?
Squeak?
Anywhere at all, but somewhere where no one remembers your name.
The Death of Rats looked around at the endless, featureless, and above all dry desert.
Squeak. You know, I think you're right.
It was in an apple tree.
He built me a swing,
Susan remembered. She sat and stared at the thing. It was quite complicated. Insofar as the thinking behind it could be inferred from the resulting construction, it had run like this. Clearly, a swing should be hung from the stoutest branch. In fact, safety being paramount, it would be better to hang it from the two stoutest branches, one to each rope. They had turned out to be on opposite sides of the tree. Never go back. That was part of the logic. Always press on, step by logical step. So he'd removed about 6 feet from the middle of the tree's trunk, thus allowing the swing to, well, swing. The tree hadn't died. It was still quite healthy. However, the lack of a major section of trunk had presented a fresh problem. This had been overcome by the addition of two large props under the branches, a little further out from the ropes of the swing, keeping the whole top of the tree at about the right height off the ground. She remembered how she'd laughed even then, and he'd stood there quite unable to see what was wrong. And then she saw it all laid out. That was how death worked. He never understood exactly what he was doing. He'd do something, and it would turn out wrong. Her mother. Suddenly, he had a grown woman on his hands and didn't know what to do next. So he did something else to make it right, which made it more wrong. Her father, death's apprentice. And when that went wrong, and its potential wrongness was built right into it, he did something else to make it right. He turned over the hourglass. After that, it was all a matter of maths, and the duty.
Hello! Hells, Glod, tell me where we are. Hello, Stolat!
Yay!
It was an even bigger audience. There'd been more time for the posters to be up, more time for the word of mouth from Ankh Morpork. And the band realized a solid core of people had followed them from Pseudopolis. In the brief break between numbers, just before the bit where people started leaping around on the furniture, Cliff leaned over to Glod.
You see that troll in the front row? He said. The one Ashfelt's jumping on the fingers of?
The one that looks like a spoiled heap.
She was in Pseudopolis, said Cliff, beaming. She keeps looking at me.
Go for it, lad, said Glod, emptying the spit from his horn. In like flint, eh?
You think she's one of them gropies Ashfelt told us about?
Could be.
Other news had travelled fast, too. Dawn saw another redecorated hotel room, a royal proclamation from Queen Kay Lee that the band was to be out of the city in 1 hour on pain of pain, and one more rapid exit. Buddy lay in the cart as it bumped over the cobbles towards Quirm. She hadn't been there. He'd scanned the audience on both nights, and she hadn't been there. He'd even got up in the middle of the night and walked through the empty streets in case she was looking for him. Now, he wondered if she existed. If it came to that, he was only half certain that he existed, except for the times when he was on stage. He half listened to the conversation from the others.
Ashfelt?
Yes, Mr. Glod?
Clifford B. can't help noticing something.
Yes, Mr. Glod?
You've been carrying a heavy leather bag around, Ashfelt.
Yes, Mr. Glod.
It was a bit heavier this morning, I think.
Yes, Mr. Glod.
It's got the money in it, yes?
Yes, Mr. Glod.
How much?
Mr. Dibbler said I wasn't to worry you with money stuff.
said Ashfeld.
"We don't mind," said Cliff.
"That's right," said Glod. We want to worry."
Ashfeld licked his lips. There was something deliberate in Cliff's manner.
"About $2,000, Mr. Glod."
The cart bounced on for a while. The landscape had changed a little. There were hills and the farms were smaller.
$2,000, said Glod. $2,000. $2,000.
$2,000. Why do you keep saying $2,000? Said Cliff.
I've never had a chance to say $2,000.
Just don't say it so loud.
$2,000!
Shh, said Ashfeld desperately, as Glod's shout echoed off the hills.
This is bandit country.
Glod eyed the satchel.
You're telling me, he said. I don't mean Mr. Dibbler.
We're on the road between Spolat and Quirm, said Glod patiently. This isn't the Rantops Road, this is civilization. They don't rob you on the road in civilization.
He glanced darkly at the satchel again. They wait until you've got into the cities. That's why it's called civilization.
Can you tell me the last time anyone was ever robbed on this road?
Friday, I believe, said a voice from the rocks. Oh, bugger.
The horses reared up and then galloped forward. Ashfeld's crack of the whip had been an almost instinctive reaction. They didn't slow down until they were several miles further along the road.
Just shut up about the money, all right? Hissed Ashfeld. I'm a professional musician, said Glod. Of course I think about the money. How far is it to Quirm? A lot less now, said Ashfeld. A couple of miles.
And after the next hill, the city lay before them, nestling in its bay. There was a cluster of people at the town's gates, which were closed. Afternoon sunlight glittered off helmets.
What you call them long sticks with axes on the end? Said Ashfeld.
Pikes, said Buddy.
There's certainly a lot of them, said Glod.
They can't be for us, can they? Said Cliff. We're only musicians.
And I can see some men in long robes and gold chains and things, said Ashfeld.
Burgers, said Glod.
You know that horseman that passed us this morning, said Ashfeld. I'm thinking that maybe news travels.
Yeah, but we didn't break up that theatre, said Cliff.
Well, you only gave them 6 encores, said Ashfeld.
We didn't do all that rioting on the streets.
I'm sure the men with the pointy blades will understand that.
Maybe they don't want their hotels redecorated. I said it was a mistake, orange curtains with yellow wallpaper.
The cart came to a halt. A rotund man with a tricorn hat and a fur-trimmed cloak scowled uncomfortably at the band.
"Are you the musicians known as the band with rocks in?" he said.
"What seems to be the problem, officer?" said Ashfeld.
"I am the mayor of Quirm. According to the laws of Quirm, music with rocks in cannot be played in the city. Look, it says so right here."
He flourished a scroll. Glod caught it.
"That ink looks wet to me," he said.
Music with rocks in represents a public nuisance, is proven to be injurious to health and morals, and to cause unnatural gyrations of the body,
said the man, pulling the scroll back.
You mean we can't come into Quirm? Said Glod. You can come in if you must, said the mayor, but you're not to play.
Buddy stood up on the cart.
But we've got to play, he said.
The guitar swung around on its strap. He gripped the neck and raised his strumming hand threateningly. Glod looked around in desperation. Cliff and Ashfeld had put their hands over their ears.
Ah, he said, I think what we have here is an occasion for negotiation, yes?
He got down from the cart.
I expect what your worship hasn't heard of, he said, is the music tax.
What music tax? Said Ashfeld and the mayor together.
Oh, it's the latest thing, said Glod. On account of the popularity of music with rocks in, music tax, 50p a ticket. Must have amounted to, $250 in Stolat, I reckon. More than twice that in Ankh-Morpork, of course. Patrician thought it up.
Really? Sounds like veterinary, right enough, said the mayor.
He rubbed his chin. Did you say $250 in Stolat, really?
That place is hardly any size.
A watchman with a feather in his helmet saluted nervously.
Excuse me, your worship, but the note from Stolat did say...
Just a minute, said the mayor testily. I'm thinking.
Cliff leaned down.
This is bribery, is it?
He whispered.
This is taxation, said Glod.
The watchman saluted again. But really, sir, the guards at Stoke...
Captain, snapped the mayor, still staring thoughtfully at God. This is politics. Please.
As well, said Cliff.
And to show goodwill, said Glod, it'd be a good idea if we paid the tax before the performance, don't you think?
The mayor looked at them in astonishment, a man not certain he could get his mind around the idea of musicians with money.
Your worship, the message said...
$250, said Glod.
Your worship!
Now, Captain, said the mayor, apparently reaching a decision, we know that folk are a bit odd in Stolat. It's only music, after all. I said I thought it was an odd note. I can't see the harm in music. And these young men, people, are clearly very successful, he added.
This obviously carried a lot of weight with the mayor, as it does with many people. No one likes a poor thief.
Yes, he went on, it'd be just like the Lats to try that on us. They think we're simple, just because we live out here.
Yes, but the Pseudopolis...
Oh, them stuck-up bunch. Nothing wrong with a bit of music, is there? Especially, the mayor eyed Glod, when it's for the civic good. Let 'em in, Captain.
Susan saddled up. She knew the place. She'd even seen it once. They'd put a new fence along the road now, but it was still dangerous. She knew the time, too. Just before they called it Dead Man's Curve...
Hello, Quirm!
Buddy struck a chord, and a pose. A faint white glow, like the glitter of cheap sequins, outlined him. The cheering became the familiar wall of sound.
I thought we were going to get killed by people who didn't like us, Glod thought. Now I think it's possible to be killed by people who love us.
He looked around carefully. There were guards around the walls. The captain had been no fool.
I just hope Ashfelt put the horse and cart outside like I asked him.
He glanced at Buddy, sparkling in the limelight.
A couple of encores and then down the back stairs and away, Glod thought.
The big leather satchel had been chained to Cliff's leg. Anyone snatching it would find themselves towing one ton of drummer.
I don't even know what we're going to play, thought Glod. I never do, I just blow and there it is. You can't tell me that's right.
Buddy whirled his arm like a discus thrower, and a chord sprang away and into the ears of the audience. Glod raised the horn to his lips. The sound that emerged was like burning black velvet in a windowless room.
I'm going to die. That's part of the music. I'm going to die really soon. I can feel it. Every day it's getting closer.
He glanced at Buddy again. The boy was scanning the audience as if he was looking for someone in the screaming throng. They played There's a Great Deal of Shaking Happening. They played Give Me That Music with Roxin. They played Pathway to Paradise. And 100 people in the audience swore to buy a guitar in the morning. They played with heart, and especially with soul. They got out after the 9th encore. The crowd was still stamping its feet for more as they climbed through the privy window and dropped into the alley. Ashfelt emptied a sack into the leather satchel.
Another $700, he said, helping them onto the cart. Right, and we get $10 each, said Glod. You tell Mr. Dibbler, said Ashfelt, as the horse's hooves clattered towards the gates. I will.
It doesn't matter, said Buddy. Sometimes you do it for the money, but sometimes you do it for the show.
That'll be the day.
Glod fumbled under the seat. Ashfelt had stashed 2 crates of beer there.
There's the festival tomorrow, lads, rumbled Cliff.
The gate arch passed above them. They could still hear the stamping from here.
After that, we'll have a new contract, said the dwarf, with lots of zeros in it.
We got zeros now, said Cliff.
Yeah, but they ain't got many numbers in front of them, Buddy?
They looked around. Buddy was asleep, the guitar clutched to his chest.
Out like a candle, said Glod.
He turned back again. The road stretched ahead of them, pale in the starlight.
You said you just wanted to work, said Cliff. You said you didn't want to be famous. How'd you like it, having to worry about all that gold and having girls throw their chainmail at you?
I'd just have to put up with it. I'd like a quarry, said the troll. Yeah? Yeah. Heart-shaped.
A dark, stormy night. A coach, horses gone, plunged through the rickety, useless fence and dropped tumbling into the gorge below. It didn't even strike an outcrop of rock before it hit the dried riverbed far below and erupted into fragments. Then the oil from the coach lamps ignited, and there was a second explosion, out of which rolled, because there are certain conventions, even in a tragedy, a burning wheel. What was strange to Susan was that she felt nothing. She could think sad thoughts, because in the circumstances they had to be sad. She knew who was in the coach. But it had already happened. There was nothing she could do to stop it, because if she'd stopped it, it wouldn't have happened. And she was here watching it happen. So she hadn't, so it had. She felt the logic of the situation dropping into place like a series of huge leaden slabs. Perhaps there was somewhere where it hadn't happened. Perhaps the coach had skidded the other way. Perhaps there had been a convenient rock. Perhaps it hadn't come this way at all. Perhaps the coachman had remembered about the sudden curve. But those possibilities could only exist if there was this one. This wasn't her knowledge. It flowed in from a mind far, far older. Sometimes the only thing you could do for people was to be there. She rode Binky into the shadows by the cliff road and waited. After a minute or two, there was a clattering of stones, and a horse and rider came up an almost vertical path from the riverbed. Binky's nostrils flared. Parapsychology has no word for the uneasy feeling you have when you're in the presence of yourself, although, strictly speaking, humans feel it all the time. Susan watched Death dismount and stand, looking down at the riverbed, leaning on his scythe. She thought, but he could have done something, couldn't he? The figure straightened, but did not turn round.
Yes, I could have done something.
How did you know I was here?
Death waved a hand irritably. I remember you. And now understand this. Your parents knew things must happen. Everything must happen somewhere. Do you not think I spoke to them of this? But I cannot give life. I can only grant extension. Changelessness. Only humans can give life, and they wanted to be human, not immortal. If it helps you, they died instantly. Instantly.